this chair squeaks, and it makes me, like, every once in a while I hear it on the background track, you know? It drives me nuts.
WD-40?
Ugh. It's a cloth chair. It's upholstered. Live from the Mundangerous Petting Zoo in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 8 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
This week, we're talking about deadly environments and faceless killers. But first, the Morning Glory campaign treks deep into the shifting jungles of Zendrick. And later, we're building private investigators in the Character Creation Forge.
I'm so glad we didn't have to make another private dick joke.
Well, maybe one more. So Shane, what's in the news this week?
Well, it's a week late, but we finally got around to reading it. The results of the survey regarding the Unearthed Arcana psionics rules came out. Wizards of the Coast published just initial readings. It was generally pretty positive. The one thing that stood out for me was that the rules interaction of psionics and magic ranked below 70%.
Yeah, this has always been sort of a bone of contention among old school players. How different or how similar are psionics and magic? And of course, you know, some people don't want psionics at all. I'm a little confused as to whether people who didn't like the interaction rules in Unearthed Arcana wanted psionics and magic to be more similar or less similar. So currently the rules, the playtest rules, the preview rules, said that psionics and magic are different, completely separate, except in cases where a psionic effect replicates a magical effect. So they'll have the same name. In those instances, it's treated like magic. You can dispel it, you can counterspell it, all those sorts of things.
So basically, the mind flayer rule.
Yeah, exactly. Right, like it's mind blast.
Right.
Right. But honestly, right now, I'm trying to think of a situation other than that where it would even come up that magic and psionics mix or don't mix.
I don't know. I think it goes back to the original problem with psionic rules, which is that the more similar you make them to magic, the less they seem to matter. And the more different you make them from magic, the less they feel like core D&D.
I could see that. I mean, okay, so it's been around for a long time, right?
Yeah, since, what, was it Dark Sun that they were created for?
I think it was even before that. I think there was an expanded psionics handbook, although don't quote us on that. But certainly Dark Sun, it's all over the place. It's baked into the system. I think that I can understand why some people don't like the feel of psionics, but I really prefer it when it is simply just another method of casting magic. You just do it with your mind. You don't need material, somatic, or verbal components, which already is a huge boost, and it uses points. It's been using points forever. Even in 4E, it still used points. Just make it point-based magic. There's already the spell point system, so it's not super weird, although again, never let your players use the spell point system.
Yeah, because that wasn't playtested either.
Yeah, it's super broken.
I don't know. I still have a problem with non-Vancian magic being tacked onto a very Vancian system.
But I hate Vancian magic, so...
Why are we playing D&D then?
Because I was promised that eventually it wouldn't have Vancian magic.
Merles!
It was a promise I made to myself, so I guess I can't hold anyone else accountable.
All right, on that note, what's going on in Morning Glory?
The party just met the very grumpy Silver Flame Inquisitor, Brand Talandro, played by our very own Shane.
That's me.
And they all get together, compare notes, and realize, oh, wait, we are hunting the same man, Nistrum Shadar, who appears to be a disgraced Inquisitor himself, but also seems to be a member of the House of Shadow, which doesn't seem to make any sense. So, of course, they've got some pieces of the puzzle, but they want to find more. So they decide to join forces because who wouldn't trust a paladin? Which you sort of were at that time.
I was a paladin.
Yeah.
I was cleric paladin at the time.
Oh, yeah.
In that particular level of the playtest.
Yeah.
Or version of the playtest.
And all signs pointed west. When you were being held in thrall by a vampire, you knew that Nistrum made frequent trips west and then returned travel weary and dirt stained. And the party talked to a few seers, prophets, not countries, and had learned that their destination lay to the west.
So we set off into the jungle.
Yes, the ever-shifting jungle of Zendrick, which, if you don't know, is under a curse.
Yeah, why don't you explain that? Because that's one of the cooler things about Zendrick, in my opinion, is the background of the Curse of Zendrick.
Yeah, 40,000 years ago, the giants got a little uppity, started killing all their elf slaves in order to utilize blood magic, and the dragon said, ooh, this is probably a bad idea. So they annihilated the entire giant civilization. There were some invaders from the Plane of Dreams, but, you know, let's not get into too many spoilers. But anyway, ever since then, anytime a creature has wanted to travel anywhere in the continent of Zendrick, they have been led astray by the Traveler's Curse. And so the party set out, knowing full well that they would have a very difficult time trekking through a dangerous jungle filled with dinosaurs. Yes, dinosaurs. Horrible weather, very hot weather, and all sorts of unknown hazards.
Do you want to talk about the Ring of Storms? Because that was possibly our most hazardous hazard of all.
Well, they knew they were headed to a place called the Ring of Storms, so foreshadowing.
There were storms.
Yeah, and I don't know, I felt like you guys may have wanted to get like potions of lightning resistance, but nobody did that.
No, homie, don't play that way.
Did it not feel like, oh, hey, we're going to a place where there might be lightning?
I was too new to the group. So I didn't really want to, you know, step on anybody's toes.
You don't want to be like, hey, I know you guys have been doing this for a while and you're still alive, but I don't know, potions of lightning resistance?
Yeah, I didn't know if those were things. It was a crazy time in the playtest.
Yeah,
lots of things didn't exist that should have existed in D&D.
And lots of things that really shouldn't have existed did exist, but that was kind of my fault because I hacked together some magic items.
Yeah, see, so it was just, you know, if you didn't spell it out in front of me, it was difficult to know.
All right, fine. I will stop blaming you guys out loud. So, of course, the trip into Zendrick was hazardous, but let's talk about dangerous journeys and dangerous locations in general, yeah?
Yeah, deadly environments. That's our topic for the day.
Yes, indeed. So really what we mean by a deadly environment, and this is a loose definition, is any hazard that's not an NPC. So that can come in many different forms, right? It can be outright damage, which is usually the hazard that we're talking about, but there's also disease, poison, madness, all kinds of status effects.
Yeah, exhaustion.
But yeah, it's a, sort of a, another damage track in 5e.
Yeah, probably the least used and least common because it's just kind of buried away as an aside in one of the appendices.
Mm.
But the fatigue rules are serious. They escalate quickly.
Yeah, one level, not so bad.
Two levels, good night.
Yeah.
Good night.
It's very difficult to get to come back from that. And actually, it's really difficult to get rid of fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Far more than other systems.
It's fine, you know? It's fine.
All right, a quick list of vectors for the ways that you can affect your party members with these environments. Of course, there's traps, right? It's very traditional. I know most people don't think of dungeons when you're talking about, you know, a deadly environment. Usually you think of the elemental plane of fire, for example. But certainly, once the characters are in an area that's basically classified as a dungeon, the whole thing is basically designed to try to kill them. Try to kill them or keep them out. The whole thing is a hazard. It's hazardous. So certainly traps, the environmental effects, which could be temporary or permanent. They can be location-based. They're in the desert. In Eberron, there's the Mornland, where horrible things happen within the bounds of an entire country. We spoke about before the Plane of Fire, right? Everywhere is on fire. And then, of course, setting-based, right? Maybe the entire system you're running is in an apocalyptic setting. Maybe a seafaring campaign where you always need to worry about drowning. In Dark Sun or 40K, just using magic is dangerous and deadly. And I think my favorite is existential threats. And this sort of shows the large umbrella that we're holding over deadly environments. Really, we're talking about things that don't need to make decisions.
Right.
And those can pose challenges and opportunities for GMs. We'll get to that a little later. But existential threats, things like the Tyranids in 40K, the Borg from Star Trek.
Or zombie hordes.
Yeah, that's exactly.
The basis of zombie fiction, right, is that it's not about the zombies. The zombies are the backdrop. Mm. They're basically the environment. It's about the people.
Right. There's no reasoning with the zombies. There's no bartering or trading. And you can't fight them either, right? You can't do enough damage, usually, to fight off the zombies or the disease or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. You need to avoid or you need to mitigate somehow.
Exactly. And safety is never guaranteed for long.
Right. So Shane, what are some of the uses, some of the usefulness of deadly environments for a GM?
So deadly environments give you very predictable obstacles as a GM. Mm. So you know they're going to deal with exhaustion after a certain amount of time from being exposed in the desert, right? They're going to make those constitution checks or those survival rules, whatever they are. They also provide an opportunity for knowledgeable PCs to shine. So this is the opportunity for the ranger, for example, to help the group safely navigate.
Or the cleric to say, well, don't get bitten.
Right. Yeah. That's a good tip for zombies.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of, and it's an interesting parallel, I think, with the heist campaigns that we had talked about.
Heist encounters.
Right. Sorry. Heist encounters. The obstacles are predictable. They're almost automatons, right? They don't necessarily respond to what the players do. Like, the weather doesn't care if you've built a shelter or if you're running away. It doesn't care if you got out of the way. It's not necessarily going to chase you unless it's sentient, and in which case it's maybe not an environmental hazard. It just, if you get out of the way, great.
Yeah.
You know? And if you don't, well, it also doesn't care if there's a TPK.
Right, right. And that's sort of the cruel mistress here, is that everyone is out of their element, right? Or maybe there's one specialized PC.
Right, which, of course, gives them a chance to shine.
But other than that, you're very much at the mercy of the dice. Mm. And that is its own level of tension. When the GM has spelled out the mechanics of how this works, right? After you make that first saving throw or make that first survival roll or whatever it is, you know what your odds are. You're at the mercy of the dice.
Yeah. As a GM, I think a tactic that you usually use, and I support it, is at first the danger is unknown. You got bitten by a weir rat, right? You know, and you're thinking, oh crap, here comes lycanthropy, but how will it manifest itself? So make a constitution saving throw. Depending on what you do, it usually most GMs will then say, okay, you succeeded, but every day or every full moon or whatever, you're going to need to make another one. And if you fail, here's what happens. Well, now that's out in the open.
Right.
There's no fudging that.
Right.
Yeah.
Our stories go in that direction or it isn't.
That's right. So you'd better roll well. And as a GM, certainly it's nice to sort of take some of that paperwork off of your plate. But at the same time, now you've just got to roll with it.
Yeah.
But I think that does put some of the decision making power in the hands of the PC, right?
So, like all, you know, hazardous situations or all challenges, players are always going to try and negotiate their way out of it.
Yes.
Right? So as soon as you introduce that threat, they're going to start digging through their character sheets and their spell lists and their items and figuring out what they can do to prevent this.
Mm.
And I mean, that's sort of what builds that tension, right? That's sort of what makes these fun encounters, is that you spend some time figuring out a solution to a problem that might have one silver bullet, right? But it might just have a combination of things that give slight bonuses that end up working in the long term. And I think that kind of leads to one of the very few opportunities to introduce an actual element of horror into a high-powered, high-fantasy D&D setting. When the environment can kill you and there's nothing you can do about the environment, that's the only real threat that you're not supposed to win against. If you think of, even in a setting like Ravenloft, you have very high-powered enemies, but they're not really supposed to show up until you can handle them. Right?
Right. I mean, unless you've made some very bad mistakes.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, that's on you.
Don't walk into the mist. Duh.
But in that sense, you can do everything right and you can still lose. And that's really freaking scary to a D&D player.
Yeah, I agree. Even outside of a necessarily horror setting, you might be able to defeat gods, but no one ever douses the elemental plane of fire.
Right.
It's just on fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you go there, you will be on fire.
Right.
And lots of it.
And if you stay there long enough, you'll eventually fail enough rolls that you'll die. Like,
yeah.
You'll never be safe there.
Except
right? Maybe
that one PC who happens to have immunity to fire because their mom was a gold dragon.
It was resistance to fire.
Maybe it's an epic destiny that you didn't choose. I wrote it for you and you didn't choose it.
Oh.
It hurts.
What did I take? +1 to all saves?
Yeah.
Oh no, that was the epic boon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a smarter pick up across the board.
Agreed. But yeah, I really like that it allows a GM to really create that sense of horror without it seeming like you are opposed to the players. In fact, this is an opportunity to be on the side of the players.
Yeah.
To even give them ideas, right? Have them make these intelligence checks, all these things their characters would know or could find out in order to stop this encroaching threat, because you're now no longer in charge of this threat.
Right.
And I think that's sort of a nice camaraderie building exercise in a similar way that planning for a heist can be.
Unlike a heist in most cases, like I feel like a heist is probably going to be a whole session. Hmm. This is nice because it might be the first hour or even less time, really. It could be the first half hour of a session. And then once you're traveled through that environment or once you've completed that piece of it, once you find safety, you go on with your campaign. So it doesn't have to take up that much time within your actual gameplay.
Maybe they're worse for wear because they took a little bit of damage. Maybe they're permanently scarred because they have a horrible disease that they need to deal with now. But yes, table time, it doesn't need to take that long.
Right.
And there should be a light at the end of the tunnel, whatever tunnel you create.
Yeah. Definitely. It's not fun if this is just life for the rest of the way now. That's one of the challenges of Dark Sun, is that there's very little hope.
Right. And even to continue to play in the setting as an arcane caster, eventually, you know, the players figure out ways to cast without defiling. You know, it's just they find a way around it, and it's hand-waved-ish.
Can they do that?
They can preserve. The mechanics are different in different systems, but you can learn to preserve.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I think mechanically, when you're talking about these deadly environments, these things that are happening around the PCs, you really need to make the consequences clear about what they're facing. Since, you know, the consequences can be extremely dire. Death, right? Death or an entire city wiped off the face of the earth, whatever. It needs to be clear that if you do not prepare enough, this is uncaring and unfeeling. Very bad things will happen. You need to prep or you need to hunker down and just be very afraid.
Sometimes that means you need to let your players turn back.
Yes.
Don't force them forward if they have realized they're ill-prepared and want to go back.
And that is, I think, a great thing about the encroaching horde, is that it doesn't have a mind, right? It probably won't chase you if you run away back to a safe location. Zombies a little different,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, depending on what hazard you're facing. Tyranids, you're screwed anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, you can't fight off a Tyranid horde. I mean, that just doesn't work.
Just put your bolter to your temple.
Yeah.
And get it over with.
Right.
Right. Eat a bullet for the God Emperor.
Right.
I think in keeping with the horror, the real danger when dealing with the environment is not so much failure itself, because you don't really want the party to fail, right? That's a TPK and that's boring.
Right.
It's the threat of failure. You don't need to get hit by the lightning strike. You just need to know that you could be struck by lightning.
Or you only need to get hit by lightning once to realize that maybe you should get lightning resistance. And then lightning is no longer a big threat, but you've still put the fear of lightning into your players.
Yes, and then when you take away their lightning resistance later,
it makes them very scared.
Terrified, yeah.
Even if they never actually get struck by lightning.
Again, right, exactly. Right. Totally. Yeah, and one person needs to get struck by lightning.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You want to scare five players? Hurt one of them. It's very efficient use of damage.
Hurt the big one.
Yeah, the one clad in armor.
Right. Ooh, that is really conductive.
Yeah.
Did you know lightning actually is more likely to strike the same place twice?
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Huh. Yeah, don't tell that to the Paladin or the Inquisitor.
And then I would say also, in order to keep them afraid, their precautions should temper, not necessarily negate the negative effects of the environment.
Or negate the biggest effects, but still leave some minor effects to hamper their progress.
Exactly. So, for example, when you guys were heading out into Zendrick, it was hot. It's very hot. It's a tropical jungle. And several of you were clad in heavy armor.
Yep.
However, this is actually a mistake that I made. You were able to purchase items that kept you within a reasonable temperature.
Yeah, I think we had cloaks of resistance, right?
Yeah.
Or endure elements. One of
the. Yeah, I just sort of made up the name from the 3-5 spell. But So that's interesting. This is where sort of our advice from the magic item episode sort of went awry. I followed it, but it didn't work out. One of the minor properties that you can get, they can roll randomly or choose for a magic item, is that the wearer feels comfortable within, I think it's minus 40 to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that.
Well, it's convenient. It was 121 degrees in that jungle.
Always. Constantly.
It's weird.
I rolled it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you just got cloaks, and that's all that they did, right? So relatively low-level magic items that didn't require attunement because it didn't exist at the time of the playtest.
Mm-hmm.
You threw them on, and hey, everything's comfy. So that negated the consequences. Maybe I should have offered you guys something that would have made it a little better or a little easier, or maybe up to medium armor would have been okay, but heavy armor still no good.
You say that.
I do say that.
So we can get into the details. I don't think anyone was not worried about being in the jungle. Between the challenge of navigating, right, which imposed the risk of us just getting lost permanently, between the challenges of exhaustion and the need to be able to... I think we were flying at the time. Oh, no, we were walking.
At the time, yeah, you were walking.
We were still walking.
You flew later.
So between those three things, right, it was hard enough. And then once we got into the Ring of Storms, mm-hmm. and we're dealing with storms themselves, which... scared the bejesus out of us. I think there was plenty of threat.
Okay, that's good. It's good for me to hear that you guys were worried.
I mean, just the threat of being lost forever is pretty worrisome, right?
So actually, this is another thing that it's really nice to keep in your GM toolbox. I gave you an out. You didn't necessarily know where you were going. You knew that you would get lost, and so I gave you a guide.
Ah, yes.
But I gave you a very unreliable guide.
He was very reliable, just very unsavory.
They got a bound devil.
Yes. Behemoth was his name. He was a tiny book imp.
Yes, yes he was.
He was bound in a chalice.
And you guys kind of became friends.
Yeah, Brandon, Behemoth, mm-hmm. we were kind of the buddy cop comedy of Xenadric for a while.
But he was always available there for me to lead you all astray. And since, in a sense, he was sort of the one PC that was not out of his element. Obviously, he wasn't a PC, and I didn't really give him that many powers because I didn't want him to sort of do anything to overshadow you guys. He was just sort of a utility item, essentially, mechanically speaking.
Yeah.
Right, even though he had a personality.
He had a great personality.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's because
he's a charming devil. Not... a demon.
Not a demon. Ugh. Demon. Those guys drool a lot. I should have played with the seduction a lot more. Yeah? Yeah. More seduction at the table. Would that have been good?
I was brand new to the group. That would have been frightening.
That can be another deadly environment.
Yeah.
Oh, lost in the harem.
Uncomfortable situation. I'm going to go home now. I am terrified.
But yes, you can offer your players a way to combat or to protect themselves from the environment, but perhaps that comes at a cost. And, you know, perhaps it's a different kind of cost than they may suffer if they didn't have it, and it's their choice to make.
Right.
Yeah. You guys could have blindly wandered through the jungle.
We tried.
Yes, actually, yeah, you totally did before you were like, maybe we should ask the devil.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, if your checks had been high enough, then you would have made it through. I wasn't forcing you to rely on the devil.
Yeah, I think we actually had a couple checks that we succeeded on, which were fine, and then we started rolling poorly.
I believe one was horribly, horribly blundered.
Yeah, and that's when we figured out we were in trouble.
Thanks, rolling a one.
So do you want to talk about the Ring of Storms itself then? Where the tension kind of ramped up?
Yeah, with the help of the devil Behemoth, the party sort of emerged into this area that they believed was called the Ring of Storms. And of course, they didn't really know why until they realized that there was a ring of clearings, which were the only spots where giant bolts of lightning were not striking very consistently.
Yes, and as we discussed, I think, two episodes ago, inside one of those clearings was a highly mutated Tyrannosaurus Rex.
That's canon.
And a pile of drow.
Less canon, but yes.
Yeah. They were at a standoff. They were peaceably coexisting within the safety of this particular clearing. And then old Inquisitor Brand came along to screw up the balance and get everybody killed.
See what racism does? You looked at Drow and you said, they must be evil.
Well, I'm a half-elf, so...
Okay, fair point. So, the...
Oh, I was a human at the time. I knew I would someday be a half-elf.
Right, because the...
When the final 5E rules came out.
Right, playtest retconning. But, right, the Ring of Storms was sort of the pinnacle example of the hostile environment that you guys were trudging through. And the Tyrannosaurus also incorporated another aspect of it, another hazard common in the jungle, where the was the potential for random encounters from horribly mutated creatures or old school dinosaurs, and sometimes both.
All right, so we've talked a little bit about how to use the environment and how to think about it from a story and challenge perspective. Let's talk about mechanically how to actually build these sort of environmental effects. So if you look in the DMG, there's two pages, I think, that are key. The first is page 121, which has the trap save DCs as well as attack bonuses and damage by danger level. And then there's the DMG page 249, which has tables on improvising damage. I think those are key for developing the effects that you want the party to suffer, and it scales by level.
Right. Unfortunately, the 5e DMG isn't particularly well organized, so some of the information is repeated, some of it is difficult to find and isn't in the place you'd expect. But using these two pages, we've kind of cobbled together a very simple system for adjudicating the DCs of diseases or insanity causing things or lightning bolts from the sky. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, and keep in mind while we're talking about D&D here, most systems have some sort of comparable table, or at least you can infer kind of a comparable level of challenge. You can take basically the same approach in any system. So first, you want to decide how deadly is the environment and base that on the level of character who should be encountering it. So Zendrick, for example, that Ishan designed, was levels somewhere between 8 and 15 probably. So it was pretty dangerous for us because we were relatively low level, but if we had been higher level, and when we were higher level and revisited it, it wasn't much of a challenge.
Right. And that's something that we talked about in the travel podcast, travel episode.
Right.
Initially, you want to play these out so that the characters understand how dangerous and deadly it is, and then from then on, just kind of hand wave it.
Yeah. So there's three levels of challenge that are presented in the DMG. The first is setback. So what's an example of a setback level?
I think at low levels, right, maybe just something like desert heat.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hot out. Maybe you get heat stroke. Maybe and that causes a couple dice of damage.
Right. Or maybe a level of exhaustion.
Right.
How about dangerous?
That, again, depends on the setting. It could be something like your first trip to the City of Brass in the Elemental Plane of Fire. It's not the most dangerous place on the plane, but just the fact that it is on the Plane of Fire makes it pretty dangerous.
And then finally, there's the deadly environments, which scale quite high in damage.
Yeah, that was actually my favorite. At very high levels, it's 24 d10 damage, which is just so much fun to roll.
Yeah, White Wolf players are just like, oh, I got that many d10s. And everyone else is like, hey, can I bum a d10 or 10?
And that would be something like, for sci-fi games, an unprotected trip into void space.
That's going to kill you right quick.
Hopefully. Except maybe at very high levels, where being able to accomplish a task like that makes you feel heroic, as it should.
Sure.
Holding off a wave of Tyranids and not getting completely devoured immediately.
Yeah.
You'll get devoured eventually.
Eventually, yeah. Yeah. So then after you've decided how deadly the environment should be, you need to set the save DC for those effects. And for that, I recommend just looking at the trap saves and basically treating it like a trap. 5e makes it very easy if they do something to help mitigate that effect. Just give them advantage on the roll.
Yeah, no need to muddle with the DCs. Bounded accuracy in general means that if they've done something or they have a bonus, then they've probably earned that bonus.
Right. And that works for environmental effects. It works for diseases, poisons.
Yeah. Saves versus madness in a Cthulhu setting, anything like that.
Sure. So once you have the damage and you have the save DC, you basically just have to decide, how often do we make our PCs pass that check?
And this is one of those instances where you can actually tweak it on the fly. So, you know, you decide how often a lightning bolt falls from the sky or how often they need to save against lycanthropy.
Right.
And depending on how they do, you can then sort of change the frequency later on if you want.
Yeah, and then you can also tie it to their actions and activities. So if you're in the jungles of Zendrick and you decide that at high noon you need to keep pushing forward, maybe you have to make the save for that day twice because you pushed yourself.
Right, or your new party member is very impatient because he's been trying to find this guy for 4 years and he insists that you don't rest even though it's very hot and you don't really know where you're going, hypothetically.
Yeah, man, don't listen to that guy. That guy doesn't know anything.
Never listen to new guy.
Yeah, he's probably bringing heavy armor to the jungle. He definitely brought heavy armor to the jungle.
He definitely brought baggage.
Yeah, and this is also another way for you to scale the challenge as your character's level. If they're going to spend a week in a dangerous environment, maybe they have to make that save and they might suffer that damage. If they're just going to pass through it in a few hours, hey, they probably know how to handle it. Don't worry about making the save.
Right. It's one of the things that I like about 5e is that the difficulty doesn't necessarily scale with their level, the difficulty of a particular task, right? So if you approach the same door 10 levels later, it's far easier to pick the lock.
Right.
If you return to the miasmic bog where, you know, you nearly died from asphyxiation at level 6, at level 16, it'll still be a danger, right? You'll still need to make a save most likely, but it'll be far easier for you to pass it.
Right.
And that really telegraphs to players, oh, hey, we've accomplished something.
We got better. This is a lot easier than last time.
Yeah.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Is it the sound of a fistful of dice?
It is the sound of the Character Creation Forge.
Oh.
But before we get to the Character Creation Forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We love hearing from our listener.
Listeners. There's
two of them.
Dozens of them.
Dozens.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, M-U-N Dangerous.
Or you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at Total Party Thrill.
So,
no, I lied. We're at TPTcast. Our show notes are incorrect. You can also find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we built private investigators. Shane, what does a PI do?
The PI sees things that others don't, and they know how to use that information.
Hmm.
They also know the tricks up a criminal's sleeve because they probably were one.
Or could be, but maybe they choose not to go down that path.
Ah, we're contrasting Mike from Breaking Bad with Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So what did you build? I'm liking the look of this class spread.
So I took the relatively straightforward option. I built the caster investigator. So it's a cleric 17, bard 3.
It's a nice split.
Yeah. So you are both wisdom and charisma based, which I think is fine. You know, I mean, you probably want to get strength in there so you can hit things on occasion if you want to fight or something. But
it also means that their deductive abilities come from wisdom. They feel their way through it as opposed to logicking their way out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I start with one level of cleric because you want to get your armor.
Heavy armor PI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And knowledge cleric gets juicy expertise in knowledge skills. So that's a nice first level. Then I take 3 levels of bard, and bard gives you expertise. It gives you the jack of all trades, which gives you a half proficiency in everything. It also gives you 1 inspiration die, which is a d6, refreshing on a long rest. And then at bard 3, you get 3 bonus proficiencies, which is awesome. You're going to be proficient in like every skill.
So at level 4, you've already got essentially 4 expertises, jack of all trades, and
like 900 proficiencies.
Skills or something? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something like that. Like maybe 1,000.
Every,
I can't count that high. You should have every skill that you could possibly need, and then some you don't.
Right.
But yeah, so that's not a very exciting build, right? The crux of this is in your spell selection. So the bard, you'll end up with 2nd level casting and you'll get to choose 6 spells total. So I like speak with animals, identify, disguise self, comprehend languages, detect magic, and detect thoughts. Those are all very thematic. speak with animals is probably the least so, but if you're investigating something in a forest, go find a squirrel. He might know something.
I think I really enjoy the sort of the idea of fantasy detectives because they have so many more options that normal detectives don't get.
Right, which is why you want to be a cleric, because he has a lot of options that other people don't get. From a spell perspective, you've got augury, you've got locate object, zone of truth, so you're a great interrogator, silence, speak with dead, clairvoyance, divination, locate creature, commune, gesh, legend lore, which your DM will love because he gets to give you all types of background about his world that you never read in that email. Scrying, find the path, planar ally. How handy would it be to have an archon as your planar ally? True seeing, plane shift, you know, which is just handy if you want to stop off in a place with a lot smarter people. And then resurrection. Hey, if there's a murder victim, you could just bring him back to life 100 years later and ask him how he died. And then finally, astral projection, which is basically super scry.
Super scry.
Yeah. But perhaps the ultimate ability here is at cleric 17, as a knowledge cleric, you get an ability called Visions of the Past. It's got two effects. One is object reading and the other is area reading. And both of them are freaking awesome. This is basically that ability from Sherlock Holmes when he walks into a room and notices the most minute detail and then reconstructs in his mind the exact series of events that led to that detail being out of place. You get to do that just by hanging out for 10 minutes.
It's very powerful. I like that in this build it comes at level 20. It's a really nice capstone, and also it's not going to break any games.
Right, because you'll be getting it at the very end of the game.
Right.
But you will be the ultimate investigator. That's a great capstone.
I think when world building, I like thinking about how criminals adapt to all the ways that they can get caught, and so they become that much more sneaky, right? Like, if you don't want to leave any witnesses alive, you have to kill the pets.
Not only that, but you've got to like hide their bodies. Because yeah, if right. any part of their body is left behind.
You've got to eat them. Or at least take the head.
Oh, you can't eat them. You just gotta find where you sleep. Find you that
gotta,
bucket.
You gotta go outside.
Yeah.
You gotta kill the birds.
Right.
Yeah.
Being a fantasy criminal is hard work.
Really hard work. Although maybe you just wear a mask because animals are dumb.
Yeah. That would work. You got to interrogate a smart animal. All right. So, Ishan, what did you build?
An investigator dolphin. No.
Oh, so you went circle of the moon druid?
I was considering druid. No. So, I decided to try to build Sherlock Holmes.
Who I'm sure would frown upon my magical methods of and shortcuts for investigating.
He might call it cheating, yes. Which is why I set a few rules for myself, which I think the build that I put together could be stronger with magic, but I think it's fine without it. So I said no magic, and he needs to be the smartest person alive. So obviously int-based, but the problem is that you just really don't get anything from intelligence for a non-casting class. You just don't. There's nothing it's really useful for except for
history.
Yeah, exactly. Like making those skill checks, which honestly, rogue expertise gets you a much higher history check than like just pumping your intelligence.
Yeah. It's
certainly far more effective.
Yeah.
But we're going to pump that intelligence anyway because this is Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
So there's sort of two ways to build this, and it really depends on what your goal is. The first I would call optimum utility, and that is being an effective character from 1 to 20. That's usually the main goal. What is going to make you really useful in a party? But the way that I think I would build it is something that I call optimal cockiness, because this is Sherlock Holmes we're talking about. So the entire point is to make sure that you have the maximum intelligence score that it is possible to have in the game at all times.
And that you can show it off at every turn.
Yes, exactly. So the way to do that is counterintuitive. It's actually to start as a fighter. You're actually going to do 6 levels of fighter.
That's fine, because Sherlock Holmes is a canonical pit fighter, right? He's an excellent boxer.
Yep, absolutely. And as we'll see, the Battlemaster Fighter, I think, works really well. So you can start with a gnome. They get plus 2 intelligence, but he's not a gnome, right? He's not even short. So I actually prefer Variant Human. You buy a 15 intelligence, you get a plus 1 from Variant Human, you're at 16, and you use your feet to get either Keen Mind or Observant, which gives you plus 1 to intelligence. Now you're at 17, which is the highest possible starting intelligence for a PC.
Yep.
And you've got Keen Mind or Observant, both of which are excellent feats. Choose carefully, because in other variants of this build, it might be at level 8, even level 10, before you get another feat. So whichever one you really want to use. But if you're going max cockiness, it's fine. Pick either one. Because the reason you pick fighter is they get an ability score increase at level 4 and then another one at level 6. So at level 4, you are going to bump your intelligence by 2. That puts it in 19. Still the highest it's possible for a PC to have. And you are also now on par in terms of intelligence with any character that has a headband of intellect. So any cheaters out there who have just bought their intelligence, you are now just as smart as them.
Does that drive you crazy, that recommendation? To go to an odd number intelligence and take a feat to go to 19? Or sorry, take an ability score increase to go to 19 instead of a feat to get you to 18?
Yeah, it does a little bit. I considered this. I was like, okay, the optimal thing to do would be to take a feat, get the extra bonus, right? Either Keen Mind or Observant, which you didn't take.
Right.
Take that, you get to 18, you have the same bonus, and you have a bonus from a feat. Great.
Not maximum cockiness.
It's not, right. It's not maximum cockiness. And once I remembered that the headband of intellect exists, I had to say, oh, well, no, absolutely, you have to go to 19.
Right, you got to at least match that.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. You can't stand around for two levels when it's uncommon, right?
Right. Sherlock Holmes would not stand for that.
Absolutely not.
And he definitely wouldn't use one.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely no way, right? So
he might use it like as a backup.
Well, maybe it's his cocaine.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, so he would never talk about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then at level 6, you get another ability score increase because you are a fighter and you take the feat that you didn't take. That bumps you up to intelligence 20. You are the smartest person alive. If at some point you can get your hands on the tome that bumps your int by 2, then yeah, I think Holmes would do that.
Yeah, he would.
Yeah, totally, because it's permanent. But Battlemaster Fighter also gets you at level 3 proficiency in an artisan tool of your choice. So obviously you're going to take the violin.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe it would be the magnifying glass.
Oh, that would be good too.
But violin does seem.
Well, so you'll have the opportunity to take tools from your background, right?
Yeah. Because
you can, you know, select a smattering. So you could do one or the other. Maybe you want to start with the violin. And of course, you want to be able to speak German, right? So that you can tell that says Raka.
Right. Which Dwarven will probably cut it.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah. So that's Fighter 6. You may as well go to Fighter 7 to get Know Your Enemy, which allows you to study a person for 1 minute and then deduce 2 mechanical things about them. Their hit points, their constitution score, the number of fighter levels, things like that. That's, I think, certainly something Holmes would do. And depending on your GM, you might be able to say, okay, what if I study them for another minute? Can I get another 2? That certainly won't be game-breaking. And from a very normal reading of the rules, that looks like something that you could do. So, you know, I would at least pitch it. From there, the best things to do, I'm super excited about this, Ranger 1.
Right? Which Ranger?
A 1-level Ranger dip. The
PHB Ranger.
Yes, right, because that's what we have to work with right now.
Right.
But actually, because I like favorite enemy, because Holmes he's a bit of a misanthrope, so you can take 2 humanoids. You take human, right, because you want to know humans and you kind of don't like them anyway.
Right.
And then you pick whatever humanoid race is the most common in the setting that you're playing in. Because, of course, he wants to maximize his abilities.
Or the most common in whatever fighting pit he happens to box in.
Mm, that's true too, right? Yeah, I suppose if you're in a city that maybe the crime syndicate is run by halflings, maybe you take halfling.
Halfling,
yeah. Right, exactly. And then rogue. I mean, obviously rogue, right? If you want to mix in rogue or ranger earlier, that means delaying max intelligence, right? So you're not playing max cockiness. But certainly, if you're going to go the most optimal route, then you're actually going to start Rogue, then Ranger, then drop in the Fighter. But Rogue, it's sort of self-explanatory. You're going for expertise. Cunning action is nice. Those sorts of things. Sneak attack is very Holmesian, but you're really just gunning for Rogue 11 reliable talent. Mm-hmm. So any thing that you have proficiency in, you can't roll less than a 10. So Holmes is, he's not only very intelligent, but he very, very rarely makes mistakes.
Right.
And that I think sort of really exemplifies it really well. Ranger also, I forgot to mention, gets you track. It makes your tracking a little better, right? So you get bonuses to, making checks about your favorite enemy, which includes humans. But you can also take a look at tracks and determine size, number, those sorts of things, which are absolutely things that you're going to want to do at a crime scene.
Yep. So that takes us to 20.
Yes, it does.
Which means we have to go back to the scoreboard.
Well, well, well. So, Shane, which detective would you rather play?
I take the easy way out, and my character is a 17th level cleric, which is perfectly fine to play on its own. So I will take that.
Wouldn't even need to be a detective at all. Yes, I agree that it is an excellent character.
I think you voted for mine accidentally.
Nope. I agree that it is an excellent character. I would still play my Sherlock Holmes clone. Judging my character mechanically, I think it is less powerful than the 17th level cleric, and perhaps less flexible, but it's still a very effective character, right? It's 8 levels of fighter, so you get all the fighter goodies. You still got your 2 attacks, 11 levels of rogue. You're just basically a dex-based fighter that also happens to have max intelligence, and that doesn't hurt the build. So I'm really happy about slipping that in. I would like to play Sherlock Holmes.
All right. Well, there you have it. The scoreboard now sits at Shane 5, Ishan 7, Abstinence 2.
Although we would be tied if you hadn't abstained twice.
And on that note, it is time for me to beg for reviews.
I'll join you.
You can catch our show on iTunes, and if you are so kind as to give us a 5-star review or 5-star rating, that would be great. It helps other people find the show, and we will read any 5-star review on the air.
Or have someone who sounds good read it on the air.
Let's get one review under our belt before we commit to bringing in third parties. You can also find us on Stitcher. Stitcher is like a Pandora for podcasts. It curates your feed based on your interests. So if you like our show, please give us a like or a favorite. All of those things will help other people find our show.
Or a star, or a moon, or a clover, maybe a horseshoe.
Okay.
Rainbows and red balloons.
You're always after my lucky charms. So, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We'll be talking about villains.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We will be building vampire hunters.
Ah, Van Helsing.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's it for episode 8 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.